Hi, you're with Truth News Radio Australia on the 25th of July 2011. My name's Hereward Fenton and welcome to another show. Tonight, dedicating the whole show to a really important topic, something that I think all our listeners will recognise as one of the key struggles going on within Australian society and globally as well. I'm bringing onto the show back to the show, in fact, John Bursell, aircraft engineer and long-time member and organiser for the 9/11 Truth Movement. Now, John, of course, has been on the show many times before talking about questions in relation to 9/11, but tonight I'm bringing him back for a discussion of the ongoing industrial dispute between engineers at Qantas and the management of Qantas. And just before we get into that, I just want to point out that this show is the first in a new format that we're running, where I'm actually it's a shorter schedule, a tighter schedule, because we're warming up for a live delivery of this show through a platform in the United States. So the segments are going to be shorter. We're going to be cutting to breaks automatically. It's going to be out of my control. At the moment, it's still just a podcast, but within the next few weeks, we're hoping to move this to a live format. So in some senses, this is a bit of a trial run. I hope you can appreciate that, and we're really looking forward to getting this show on a live footing. And without further ado, just let me welcome John to the show. John, are you there?
G'day, Hereward. I'm here.
Welcome back. It's been a long time.
It has been quite some time. Yeah, that's true. And I'd just like to start off by saying congratulations to Goodell Evans, who won the greatest race in the world yesterday with Great Australian Achievement.
That is quite remarkable. Yeah, I haven't really been following that, but I did see that in the news. And yeah, great, good honour. Yeah, really, really impressive. I mean, it's hard stuff, isn't it? Yeah.
It is. Yeah. It just goes to show that Australians are quite tenacious.
Yeah, we are, aren't we? And, I mean, you've been pretty tenacious. Now, you've pulled back a little from involvement in 9/11 activities, and we're going to discuss that a bit later in the show. But I'm actually now free to reveal for the first time who your employer is. We've had you on the show as an aircraft engineer, as an expert, and that's been very important. But, of course, we've had to be a little quiet about you know, employer issues. But tonight you've come on because you are actually in the union for Qantas. You are an engineer at Qantas. And, of course, the industrial dispute at Qantas is now about to go into its most serious phase, as I understand it, with a full strike looming. And you guys are basically, as I see it, you guys are standing up for the most important issues, which is safety and long-term security of Australian travellers. And, of course, it relates to your jobs as well. I mean, we know that the company wants to outsource the work to Singapore. And, of course, that's going to impact negatively in the long term. But as I understand it, you've been offered pay raises in the short term. And so Qantas is trying to soften you up to this idea of outsourcing. So I just want to say I'm really totally with you. I think all the listeners to this show are totally with you in what you're standing for.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, let me just firstly say that obviously I am employed by Qantas now. The reason I don't think that's an issue anymore in the world that we live in today of information. Obviously, anyone that goes to Facebook knows that I'm employed by Qantas, and you can find it anywhere on the web that I'm employed by Qantas. When I speak on about 9/11 truth issues, it's definitely not anything to do with Qantas. And speaking today, I'm not speaking on behalf of the Australian Licensed Aircraft Engineers Association, which I am a delegate. And I do talk regularly to the negotiating team that are talking to Qantas regarding our enterprise agreement. But I'm not talking on behalf of them or on behalf of Qantas, but I'm just here to give a bit of a view of, you know, the ethical things, the ideas that are behind what's happening, and the things that we're fighting for in a general sense, and to explain to the listeners what the fight's all about, And I think you've just pointed out that we're heading into a very interesting stage, a very a very adversarial stage of Qantas engineering versus Qantas management. Also, we have the long haul pilots that are now officially in dispute as well, and we have the TW, also the ramp personnel that are just moving into dispute as well. So we've got a lot of different elements of the Qantas now that are at loggerheads with the management, and it boils down to two or three basic issues. Now, you brought up the fact that we're fighting for aircraft safety. That's always been the main concern of the Aircraft Engineers Association. And, we've carried on that fight to try to maintain the standards in Australia in all airlines, including Virgin and Jetstar and other airlines all around Australia. But Qantas is the icon. Qantas is the number one engineering company in the world as regards aviation, or it was. It's on the cusp now of moving away from that. And, we're fighting for that. We're fighting for the long-term survival of heavy maintenance in Australia, which is the overhaul maintenance of aircraft. We've already lost the major portion of overhaul of our engines and components of aircraft. That's already sort of pretty much gone offshore, or it's been outsourced. So there's two things: outsourcing, which is taking it out of the Qantas direct control and can be within Australia, and also, offshoring, which is sending the work overseas completely, still with some Qantas obviously Qantas oversees these things that happen overseas, and they oversee the third party work in Australia. But we're moving to the stage now where, approximately 50% of what's done, engineering works done on aircraft for Qantas aircraft, is going to be done overseas or by third party people. So it's a time where, we're really trying to preserve an idea of safety in aviation where there's no allowable crash. That's really what it's all about. Right. Where Qantas is moving to the world's best practice, and just like many other airlines have, and most airlines in the world have already, which means allowable crashes.
Right, allowable crashes. When crash, you mean actually plane crashing, you mean?
Yeah, it's risk management. So, right. I mean, really, they hope that never happens. They don't expect it to happen, but the simple facts are that if you start to remove certain controls and certain layers of, expertise and you start to dumb down your workforce and remove professional people from the front line of your maintenance and also from directly overseeing the maintenance on the components, the people within the company that have, been in that company 20, 30, 40 years, the people that have seen that company, go through a lot of hard times in the past, the people that have been there to build the company up, they're the ones that really care about the brand. And maybe the difference with Qantas is that we have a situation where the people that look after the planes today take it very personally, their jobs and what they do. And the overseas model is really a very disassociated model where, everyone's a contract, everybody's just part of a process, part of a control and accounting process.
Where they're just a cog. They're all just cogs in the wheel. They're all just part of some giant system.
Exactly, and that's the sort of way the world's going, this corporatism, accountants running the show. Now, obviously, if anyone knows anything about the history of Qantas, it was the company was created by an engineer and two pilots. Engineering and pilots are the mainstay of aircraft safety, and they're also the main part of the airline. Most of the other people within the airline, of course, being very important, don't require anywhere near the level of training or experience to do their jobs. Qantas pilots have saved Qantas from accidents many, many times because of their great skill. And the fact that to be a captain on a Qantas aircraft is such a it's such a high level of achievement within the piloting ranks that it's sought after. We get all the best pilots, and same with engineering. Qantas engineering has always drawn the very best kids leaving school, to go into that job. So, once that changes into a place where it's dog eat dog and it's the lowest world's best practice model, things change forever, and that's really the cusp that they're at now. We're talking about removing licensed aircraft maintenance engineers off the tarmac, which means that they won't be looking at the aircraft before dispatch. They'll still be looking after the aircraft as per the minimum requirements, which is world's best practice now, where basically we have the porters, the people that load the bags on the planes that look after the ramp handling of aircraft,
right,
until the overnight checks are done and the before service checks are done. We're talking about removing, you know, people that actually understand the aircraft, that know how they work, know how they operate, understand the materials, understand the systems of the aircraft. We're taking them out of the mix. So that means when a pilot lands and he pulls up at the gate, there's not somewhere there to talk to that understands the aircraft that can converse with him about problems. And it just really just removes this layer shocking.
I'm totally appalled at this. I mean, it's worse than I thought.
But and that's what's allowed, like with the new and to give, you know, to give the other side of the coin here, the side that the Qantas sees, and this is the standard practice around the world now, really, except for if an aircraft's traveling a long distance or if it's you know, extended range within Australia, which is, you know, some flights, you know, there doesn't have to be an engineer attend the aircraft unless there's a defect, unless there's a fault. So at the moment where we have engineers dealing with the aircraft as they turn around everywhere in Australia and doing it reasonably efficiently and also providing a better service to the customers. That's why we have the best dispatch reliability in Australia. You know, we're talking about removing that layer of safety and just giving it to the porters, which, you know, obviously saves them money. And not that the porters are willing to do this at this stage. They're in dispute about it too. They don't want to do that job. They want us to do that job. But the simple fact is that around the world, the world's best practice says that you put the engineer in a glass case and you break the case when he's needed. That's what they want to do because they don't want to be paying the money for someone that's qualified to be out there on the tarmac.
So just to clarify, this is what they call best practice, but in fact, it's not as thorough and it's not as fail-safe as what you've been previously doing. So this best practice is less good than the current system, which has that extra level of personalized attention. So it's a bit of a weird kind of play on words, isn't it? Best practice.
It is. Well, it's best profit practice is really the way to put it.
You know, it's what key, happens. Yeah, that's the
when
key.
When you have a board that's, you know, overseeing the company that has no aircraft operational experience, they don't understand the complexity of these things. Now, the ALEA and obviously people that are, you know, interested in the safety of airlines, you know, there are other ways of achieving a better level of safety without going to that model. There's other models out there, like, say, for instance, if we have a tradesman or a aircraft mechanical engineer or aircraft maintenance engineer, an AME, meet the aircraft that does have understanding of the aircraft. He's not highly trained, but we have him meet the aircraft, and then we have the highly trained licensed aircraft maintenance engineer drop by the aircraft while it's on the ground and just have a chat with the crew, make sure everything's okay, and inspect the book to make sure that the aircraft's, you know, in a serviceable condition. That could save considerable money, and we can move to that model, which might actually be the world's best practice, you know, considering the price pressures. So there are things like that on the table, but the problem that both the pilots and the engineers and other units are having.
It's okay, John. We're just about to go to break. Thanks. I really want to get into this question of the kind of risk factor and the fact that they're prepared to actually bring risk into it to save money. That is just absolutely staggering. So we'll get into that right after the break. Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Welcome back to the show. Tonight I have John Bursell on, and John Bursell, aircraft engineer, longtime member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, also a prominent member of the Qantas Union of Aircraft Engineers. And John is explaining the incredible, what we call best practice, that is now being imposed on Qantas staff, Qantas processes and procedures, whereby risk is actually now increased. And that's what they're calling best practice, because they're actually taking away some of the checks and balances and sort of moving towards what is a globally accepted practice, which of course affects the bottom line in terms of profits. Now, John, one thing I just want to sort of hone in on is, do you believe that Qantas management is aware? I mean, have they done an actuarial analysis of the actual risk by doing whatever form of practice they do? I mean, I assume that they have people whose job it is to look at risk.
And, of course, yeah. I mean, yeah. Risk assessments everyday process. Like, I do risk assessments regularly in my job. Obviously, they've looked at the risk. And this is like this. What I was saying to you before was just getting on the fact that, you know, we are like, as the employees, we're offering up models that we can reduce costs and also maintain that level of safety, you know, or as close to it as we can, you know, considering.
Sure.
And Qantas aren't interested in that. So the issue for Qantas is to cut costs and to get control back from the workers, because really after the last dispute, it cost Qantas in excess of $100 million when they had a dispute with us. Prior to that, there hadn't been a major dispute with engineering and Qantas for its whole history. Same with the pilots. This international pilots strike that's looming now will be the first time that the pilots have ever taken industrial action against Qantas. And this is indicative of the situation, because we have a situation where people that have been in the company all these years and have had great, you know, invested a lot of time and effort and long hours of work and experience, you know, see the airline being taken to this world's best practice when Qantas was above the world's best practice by a margin. You know,
wow.
There are other airlines that were similar around the world as well, but none that had the same record as us. So the Qantas brand is all about engineering and pilots. That's what it's always been about. You know, and you know, also other aspects of the fact that it's an Australian business, and Australians have this innate sense that when something's wrong, you know, with the processes, they will, you know, well, they're sort of compelled, as Australians, sort of the way that we are. I know we're the same in the military. From my experience in the military, we'll speak up to authority. We'll stand up and say, "Hey, that's wrong. This plane is grounded until we fix it." And in my industry, if I turn around and say the plane's grounded because there's a problem, there won't be another engineer that steps forward and says, "Oh, no, that plane's going to fly," because right. That's not how it works in Australia. In Australia, we'll look into it, sure. If the plane is serviceable and I was overreacting or I made a mistake, the plane would fly again, of course, once it was assessed. But no one would just simply pick up a pen and sign the plane out. But this sort of process happens overseas all the time.
Sure.
You know, pen whipping, whatever you want to call it. I've worked overseas in Asia, and I know for a fact that a lot of the jobs that they say are done by the paperwork demonstrates the job done. It's not actually done, and people just simply sign things off. And, you know, that removes a great level of safety, because that process or that inspection or that check or that maintenance that was to be performed is there because, you know, Boeing or whoever the aircraft manufacturer is knows that if it's not done at that time, you know, that's the increase. There's a great increase in risk of having a problem, an incident or accident. So, you know, when these things are removed because people, you know, are under pressure to get things done, it's a contract situation, they've got no investiture, they've got no, you know, no real love of the company that they work for, they're not going to be there for their whole career like they are in Qantas. You know, they're not going to do those sorts of things. And that's the difference with Qantas. Even though we might be moving to a practice that's done worldwide and it might be still safer than driving in your car, you know, because let's face it, it's more dangerous on the roads than it is flying in a plane. The thing with Qantas is that the staff were so good at their job and did so well that they were actually saving the company money. And this is the problem that some people don't see, and some commentators you'll see in the media don't understand, is that since Qantas sent or has outsourced all its engine maintenance to either overseas or in-house, it has cost them millions and millions and millions of dollars. engines because the engines have failed. I mean, previously Qantas had the absolute best record in the world for engine maintenance. Our engines used to be on the wing and run for longer and better and cleaner than anyone else's engines in the whole world. Now we've gone to this world's best practice and we're getting it done overseas at a cheaper rate. We're actually having more problems and more incidents, and it's costing far more money in lost time and putting passengers up, and the brand is suffering. You know, right. And the brand's what Qantas is all about. If Qantas is not seen as the safest airline on the planet, and it's not seen as this iconic Australian carrier anymore, then what is it?
Right, right.
You know, and this is the thing. Why can't we be better than the world, and why can't we find a way to reduce the cost but still maintain that safety level? And that's what the ALEA is all about, my association. That's what the pilots – everybody's prepared to negotiate. You'll hear Qantas saying that we're not prepared to negotiate. That's absolutely not true. What we're trying to do, Bud, is we're trying to secure – if they want trade-offs on efficiency by, you know, doing certain things, then obviously we want to secure our jobs – as part of that package. You know, we're looking for an arrangement where everybody benefits. Now, that's what unionism is all about, right? That's what, you know, that's what the Australian worker is all about, is fighting the company to get a better product for the customer, to get a better product, you know, for everyone, and to get a better outcome for everyone. And it's provable that the decisions Qantas has made over the last few years to outsource maintenance has cost them money. It hasn't saved them money. You know, where is the smarts in that? And now they're on that role. That's the way they're heading. They want to see it out right till the end, which is basically where everything's, you know, contracted out away from the mainstay of the company. So the accountants and the managers that don't understand the industry, really, they don't understand the nitty gritty of operating aircraft, can deal with the situation, because they only have to deal with that contract company. They just ask, you know, if they. They ask that company to provide a service, and then they only have to deal with the one manager. They don't have to deal with the actual workforce. And dealing with engineers and pilots and the technical nature of aircraft is difficult. And I think there's a real resistance from Qantas management to actually get into it and find a new, you know, way of doing things that can save them money.
It just seems to me there's something ruthless about it.
You know, provide the public with safety that they need, and also maintain the high standard that we have.
I know, and look, on the news, I've been hearing the news reports, and of course Qantas is saying that you guys are just using the safety issue, that it's not the real issue, that you're kind of harping on the safety issue, and I think there was an incident recently that was cited as an example. I'm not exactly sure on the details, but I know that a lot of representatives of the Qantas unions have been saying, look, there's going to be a lapse of security, a lapse of standards, and this is going to lead to more such events.
Well, it's happened, so you know we know it's true. We're not drawing a long bow with these arguments, and
yeah.
You know, we've been quite reserved really about what the reality of the situation is. But there's numerous incidences that are on the public record that are related to the fact that we're not doing that maintenance in-house. Like, say, for instance, with the 380 engine problem with the Rolls-Royce engine, that right. was down to machining of a pipe, you know, in the inner workings of the engine that caused, you know, not enough oil to get to the engine, and it had a problem and it exploded.
One so of this the is a recent exploded. Incident, wasn't it, within the last couple
yeah,
of
yeah.
weeks?
Yeah, and yeah. those pilots, you know, the computer said no as far as landing that aircraft. The, right. the plane was unlandable as per the computers, right?
Right.
But those Qantas pilots landed that aircraft. Now, do you think some guy that's, you know, on half as much money that's not the top, you know, pilot in the world, like our 380 captains are the creme de la creme, right?
Right.
So, you know, do you think some guy that's got a few thousand hours on, you know, 20 aircraft could handle that situation? But our guys did, and they landed the aircraft. Now, the reason that engine broke down was a manufacturing fault. It wasn't Qantas' fault. And this is where this risk management comes in. Qantas is happy to have problems if it's someone else's fault. That seems to be the way they think.
Okay.
You know, I'm sure they've got, you know, $100 million payout or something off Rolls Royce, something like that. You'll find it in the press. You know, and sure, that might compensate them. But the fact is that, you know, there was all those people terrorised. You know, the plane's wrecked. It's still being fixed. You know, and the thing is that if we had have had those engines being overhauled in our engine shops, our guys, you know, would have noticed these, you know, these this data coming from the engines, and would have looked into these parts, and they would have found out that there was problems, and like we have many, many, many times before in Qantas, we're the ones that actually suggest the repair schedule to Boeing and Rolls-Royce.
Okay.
You know, we'll actually come up with a repair for these things. Now, those engines probably would have never got to that stage if our guys had been pulling them down and looking for the fault. They would have found the fault, not a third party outside of the country that doesn't have a particular interest in telling Qantas about the problem. I think Singapore Airlines were probably more concerned about their engines getting fixed up first than they were Qantas engines, wouldn't you imagine?
I would definitely assume that. We've got another break coming up. Tight segments here, not like our old Truth News show where we could ramble on. So we're just going to go to a break. I'm going to put a song on. Are you good to stay with us for the next half, John?
Yeah, no problem.
Great, great. Just going to a song here by Leonard Cohen. 1,000 Kisses.
The gifts that you young. The odds are there to be. You win a while, and then it's done. Your little winning streak. And summer now. It's real. A thousand kisses deep.
To the show. Today we're talking about the Qantas industrial action. I've got John Bursell on the line. We've been going through some of the key issues that the union is bringing to Qantas and the way in which this is being applied, the way in which the company is trying to basically save money essentially by adopting what they call world's best practice, which is actually a reduction in some of the quality. And John, earlier when we were talking, you told me that that there are a whole lot of strike breakers that have been brought in that are being kept ready to step in when and if you guys basically down tools. Is that still the case?
Well, the usual way with these things that, you know, managers have been trained back up and they've been reactivated, you know, as far as their licenses go, so they can certify for the aircraft. There's a group of scab labour that's sitting off to the sideway, you know, off to the side in hotels around Australia, you know, being paid approximately $5,000 a week just to sit there.
Right.
Yeah, you know, Qantas in management, you know, want to win this battle with us. And like you said earlier, you know, if we just take a pay rise and shut up, they'll retrench some of us and they'll just let it all, you know, it'll all just happen. It'll be a nice ride for us all. We can just all watch what's going to happen. And then people like myself will be fine. You know, we'll be all right because we've got the qualifications they need and we're still needed, but it's not about that. You know, it's about the future of aviation. And I'll just make a few key points. We might leave it at that. Okay. So the main claims that we're making is, you know, that we want the future 380, the Airbus 380 maintenance, heavy maintenance to be done in Australia. We want the 787 that's coming further down the track also to be carried out in Australia, the heavy maintenance. If we lose that ability to do it, it means that we can't operate the aircraft without, you know, outside organisations outside of Australia helping us, you know, to achieve those things. Now, in the past, these things for a small country like Australia were facilitated with help of the government. Now, that's another issue in this matter. It's not just about Qantas. Now, Qantas is in a situation where they're competing against other carriers that do have support from their governments and do have a situation that is easier because of where they're situated in the world or because of their, you know, the cost of labour and a whole lot of other issues, right? So Qantas have real issues as well. There's no doubt about that. You know, previously, to build a hangar and to set up an operation for heavy maintenance is an expensive process and something a government would be interested in doing for a whole lot of reasons, including national security, including, you know, many jobs, including maintaining technology and standards, all these things, having an involvement in the industry worldwide, okay, which Qantas has hit way, way above its weight in the past. You know, right. It has provided a great service to the world in a way, you know, as the second oldest airline in the world. And anyway, so there's all these reasons about national pride and a whole lot of things that come into the mix of this argument. Now, at the stage we are at the moment, only about 5% of the heavy maintenance of the aircraft is being done overseas, okay? Some of it's been done inside Australia by other operators, but they're still under the control of licensed aircraft engineers and, you know, the standards are still high, okay? So we're not gone yet, Okay, sure. So the bright side is that if we can maintain that heavy maintenance, which is really where the flight controls are played with and adjusted and overhauled, and you know all the high-tech autopilot systems are tested, everything else like that's still done in Australia. So sure, some of the components are done overseas, but they've got to pass a bench test before they get let loose onto the aircraft. So, and with a good inspection regime and good quality control, we can probably control that aspect. But the heavy maintenance side is the big issue. The other big issue is keeping engineers on tarmac, keeping engineers with the aircraft during the day and during the evening when the aircraft are operating. They're the two things that Qantas want to move all heavy maintenance offshore in time with the new generation aircraft, so the aircraft that are coming through. So there will be no facility in Australia to do heavy maintenance on Qantas jets in the future.
Right.
That's what they want. But it's demonstrably what they want. It's not the situation at the moment, and but we've had to fight to maintain the situation as it stands now. And they also want to, you know, go to this world best practice model where we have, you know, porters or ramp staff receiving and dispatching the aircraft without that conversation between the pilot and the engineer at every turnaround that we have in Australia now, which is a very safe practice. But it's not. You know, we can go lower than that. We're allowed to go lower than that under law. So right. that's what the company's doing. It's just saying, well, we just want to operate as per what CASA says. Mm. And, you know, we want to go to that world's best practice model, which is not as safe as it is now. It's a simple fact. It's not as safe.
It's such an irony. The use of words, it's I don't know, Orwellian. We use the word Orwellian too much, but it is Orwellian. I mean, to say world's best practice when it's actually worse is just – it's a misuse of just a misuse of language and meanings. I don't know.
I had a discussion at the at our conference with the Australian Licensed Aircraft Engineers Association with the CEO of CASA, Australia's safety organisation.
Yeah.
Now, he knows, like I was talking to him around some of the issues about terrorism, etc. He knows that the things that keep airlines safe are good practices, good engineers and good pilots. They're right. The things that keep the passengers safe. Not getting their testicles felt at the airport. That doesn't keep, you know, terrorism is not an issue in Australia as far as aircraft goes. And the way that we you know, the money that we spend on those sorts of things and the money that we spend on things that aren't so important, you know, on the propaganda and on the PR campaigns and all these other things that airlines do now and companies do and all the spin and all the arguments and the fights they have with their workers while they try to destroy unionism, which has preserved this economy in this country because we've still got a middle class. You know, like the reasons, you know, this is a battle that we're fighting that's about globalism. It's about, you know, the race to the bottom. You know, that's really, we're really fighting that in this campaign. All those things are there as well, you know, and it's just worth thinking about it in the bigger picture that Australia can still be the best place in the world to live. You can still have the safest aircraft. We can afford it. We're a rich enough country to have that sort of place to live in. Now, other places in the world aren't. But, you know, do we want to be like everywhere else or do we want to continue to be the best in the world, like Adele Evans? He's the best push bike rider in the world at the moment. We love to have the best sportsman. What's wrong with having the best industrial standards and the best aircraft? What's wrong with that, you know?
Well,
everyone has to do it in Australia, then it doesn't provide a cost barrier, does it?
It just seems to go against the zeitgeist.
You're paying less for an aircraft ticket now than when I started working at Qantas 25 years ago. You're paying less now. How much less do you want to pay? You know, where do we end? Where does it end up? I don't understand it. It's like it's the way the world's going with this corporatism and globalism. It's really not doing anyone any favors. You know.
Yeah, and we've all got to do what we can to roll it back. I mean, this point you made about the security, the elaborate and expensive money they spend on the security theater, and the fact that all of that stuff isn't really making the plane safer, despite the enormous amount of money they're spending on it. And of course, they're planning new things in Australia. They are bringing in the naked body scanners, and in the UK, they've now brought in biometric iris scanners. I don't know if you've heard about that. I mean, they are just spending like there's no tomorrow on this expensive technology, as well as all the people they employ for the TSA in the US, of course. And at the same time,
and we know that the best security, like I still think it's important to have aircraft security, and I think the idea of X-raying bags is maybe not a bad idea, and the idea of profiling people, which is the most successful, having you know a person that stands there and just watches people. is and it doesn't have to touch them, but observing their psychology is the most successful way of finding people that are going to cause problems on aircraft. You know, and it's but we go through this. We have to have all these bells and whistles with everything, and everybody's going to make money out of the security state, the military world that we live in. You know, it's and it doesn't work. It's not providing safety. Safety's in engineering, and it's in good quality pilots.
But also, like what you're highlighting is, we talk about safety, but there's a lack of concern about safety. So we talk about safety, and we bring in these elaborate security measures, and we end up X-raying people, and we don't care about the safety issue of that people are being bombarded with X-rays. To me, this all is related to this corporatist mentality that doesn't seem to care about risk, because
it's all
about
perception of risk. It doesn't matter about the real risk; it's about the perception.
Yeah, perception of risk, and if they decide, well, a certain percentage of people are gonna get the bum rap, they're gonna get the skin cancers. It's a bit like with the vaccines. You see, they say, well, yes, a certain percentage of people are gonna get injured by vaccines. We'll let that go. But then they don't even compensate those people, and they don't even acknowledge it, even though they've actually acknowledged it. You know, privately in their studies, they know, yes, these people are going to be injured. And I'm sure Qantas has probably looked at this and said, yes, we're probably going to have a few extra plane crashes that we wouldn't have had. And this is what I was really, really concerned about.
We haven't had any, and that's the difference again. You know, we're the only airline in the world that hasn't had a fatal crash in the jet era. And, and that's just something that's very valuable. And it's something that can be maintained, but you have to have, they call this Swiss, there's seven layers. When you go to an aircraft accident, there's about seven layers of what they call a Swiss cheese model. When all the holes line up, you have the accident.
Now,
if you've got really good engineers and really good pilots, it provides a firewall to having an accident. Now, when you start to have, you know, less things, you know, preventing that happening, like say, for instance, we've got porters pushing back an aircraft and one of the porters runs into the aircraft and puts a little, not even a hole, but just cracks the airframe.
Right.
Okay, and no one, because the porters are doing the departure, they don't do the final walk around. Well, they do it, but they don't really know what they're looking for. And if they're the ones that are pushed in the aircraft, they probably want to, oh, I'm not going to tell anyone, I'm going to just let that go. Now, that aircraft takes off, and we have a decompression. Now, that's fine. Okay, that's fine. We have a decompression. That's just one thing. Well, we've had two things go wrong. We've had a porter hit an aircraft. We've had it not picked up by the final inspection. Well, it's not Lamy doing it anymore. It's just a porter. Okay, he doesn't really know what he's looking for. It's not his fault.
Sure.
But anyway, the guy hits it. Then it's not noticed. Then it takes off. Then we have a decompression. Now, the plane's been overseas, and this actually happened. It's been overseas, and someone's lock-wired the oxygen bottle shut in an overseas heavy maintenance check, which happened.
Right.
Okay? The pilot reaches for his oxygen mask at 40,000 feet, and there's no oxygen.
Right, right.
Then what happens? We have a crash.
That's a disaster.
Because he's out cold in about 60 seconds.
That's a disaster. And look, I just hope
that's how easy it can happen when you remove those levels.
I just hope that the next time, you know, we talk about this isn't like after there's been a fatal crash of a 747 after these measures came in. I just hope that's not a scenario that we're going to be talking about in a couple of years, you know, because then we'll just be saying, oh, we told you so, but all these people will be dead, you know.
We've got to fight. We can still do it. We've just got to fight.
Absolutely.
Sick of the lies, deception, spin and half-truths? Well, so are we. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. Tune in every week at truthnews.com.au or subscribe to the podcast with iTunes or your favourite podcatcher.
Welcome back to Truth News. Okay, in the last segment here, John, we've probably covered the Qantas dispute as well as we can today. Just want to get back to the 9/11 truth movement. You've kind of pulled back a little, or I'd say pulled out somewhat from the 9/11 truth movement. Do you want to talk a bit about that at all, or like how it's been over the years and what you think you've actually, how you've evolved and you know, why you've pulled back? I mean, sort of up to you. Like, there's no pressure there, but...
No, well, first of all, it's a very valuable campaign, and I still talk to people about it every day. I actually went out to coffee with I'm down in Canberra at the moment with work for a month, and I went out to coffee with someone I met the other night, a very interesting person, an architect.
Right.
Anyway, her name's Katie, and that's by the by.
Sure.
But anyway, just so happens I get to talk to her about a few things, and she was in September 11, she was in New York, and she saw the towers, both the towers come down.
Wow.
And she saw Building 7 come down, and she's an architect. And it was very interesting having that discussion with her, and we talked for many hours, actually, but she was very distressed about what happened, and she was heading back over to New York for the 10th anniversary. And we only talked about 9/11 for about an hour or so, but, you know, because of my style, which I've learned over the years through listening to other people that have experience, talking to people in the street, through talking to professional people, through working in the political realm, through putting on conferences, through educating myself about what's fact and what's fiction, what's provable and what's not, I was able to address the issue with her in a way that had enough tact that she didn't storm out of our coffee.
Great.
And considering she was traumatized and has had to see a psychiatrist about it.
Wow.
And she had people that she knew died that day. Now, she saw planes hit the buildings because there's planes, and she all this other disinfo just comes flooding back to me when I'm in that situation. I feel terribly sorry for the victims of that day because of the garbage that's been circulated about 9/11 out there. And I think that's what it's all about for me, is that I just get sick of arguing people like Rob Balsamo from Pilots for 9/11 Truth that says that, you know, some sort of souped-up plane was used on 9/11 when he doesn't have any evidence that proves it. And, you know, and having to deal with the fact that people call me a shill or call me, you know, a traitor or this or that because I won't say that a plane didn't hit the Pentagon. When I know that there's people that have talked to the firefighters that pulled the dead bodies out of those buildings, out of the Pentagon, and I know for a fact through studies that accredited scientists have done that it is very well possible that a plane did hit that building, then I'm not going to stand for that. I'm not going to stand for people talking about stuff that is just not credible. And it doesn't help our campaign. It makes us look like conspiracy theorists. Now, I actually get angry these days when I get called a conspiracy theorist. And I've really started to push back and say, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a factualist. I stick to the facts. I stick to the fact that we need a new investigation. I stick to the fact that Building 7 is provably, demonstrably, you know, testimony also says so it was a controlled demolition. Even talking to this lady that was traumatized by the event and was not open to these things.
Yeah.
She knew as an architect that it fell too quickly, and she's always known that. And she said to me, she thought that it was pulled down. It was demolished, and that's what other people thought because that's what they were telling people
about Building 7 early on.
I've had this argument before with people. I said, "What are you talking about Building 7 for? Everybody knows it was demolished because that was the official line early on. Because no one thought that people would believe that it just fell down. But then later on, they decided to spin it the other way, and NIST did the investigation and came up. The crazy commuter model with one column and all the rest of it, and you can go right into the detail. Okay, we know that. Now, but what's happened to me in the campaign, I've been worn out with disinformation and having to put up with people that won't support people like me that are being reasonable, that are being factual and actually getting the job done and winning the day for the cause.
Yeah.
And, you know, you and me have done that. We've done good works and we've done our best, okay?
Yeah.
Now, it probably cost me my marriage. It cost me probably about 50 grand, maybe even more, who knows. I had a good go, okay? I had a good go. But I just don't have the stomach for it anymore, basically. That's the situation. But I still talk to people about it, and I'm still open to any interviews. I did an interview about Osama bin Laden on Triple M a little while back, and if someone rings me up and wants to talk to me about 9/11 or wants me to represent the issue, I'm happy to do that. But I'm just sick of dealing with the people in the movement, you know, the people that are conspiracy theorists.
Yeah,
I'm over it.
We've had a big problem with certain people. I mean, Jesse Ventura springs to mind. And you know,
well, that was really the last straw for me. I have to say that was probably the last straw.
Because, of course, you know, he's very influential because of his background being a governor. And obviously he can get airtime on major commercial television in the U.S. And when he starts endorsing the fringe ideas of the 9/11 truth movement and not just sticking to the hardcore facts like Richard Gage does – It's really disappointing. And I mean, I'd already decided that I was pretty well finished with Jesse Ventura. after I watched his JFK episode as part of his conspiracy series on the television show, because again, I saw a really sloppy kind of approach to evidence and what just looked like dramatizations and things that were not part of the solid hard evidence that we know just in relation to the JFK questions, branching off into murky areas. And I think, why do you do that? Like, I just don't understand it. I tend to think he's misguided. I tend to think he's misled. I think that, you know, I try to give him the benefit of the doubt and say maybe he's just not that intelligent, but it's still, whatever the reasons are, it's been very disappointing to see Jesse Ventura going down this path. Of course, we had the Charlie Veach episode, which is the other flip side of that, where you get someone who was, a fringe part of the 9/11 movement, who had a big following, then sort of being co-opted by the BBC into a kind of a propaganda flip-flop, saying that, you know, the people who believe these conspiracies are all crazy, and I was crazy, and now I'm sane again, and the fact that was all kind of under the auspices of the BBC.
In my view, but Harold, would we allow that? You know, the people in this movement, you know, the people that haven't taken the care to be factual, you know, there'll be some people listening tonight that you know, are partly to blame, because we gave him the wiggle room. We gave him the bullshit story of the flyover at the Pentagon and no plane hit there. We gave him, you know, the garbage around other aspects of the hijackers and other things that have been stated by the 9/11 truth movement, the phone calls, the this, the that, the things that are flaky.
Yeah.
Those things, the straw men are out there.
Yeah.
And all it takes is for a guy like him is to go there, someone that – because the thing is that the average Joe Blow does look at the Pentagon and think they plane hit there.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so hard to fight that argument, because – it seems reasonable. So we've just allowed, because we haven't done our job properly as researchers, and we haven't stood up for the really good people, like, you know, like people like Richard Gage enough, that, you know, that he can go out there with the BBC and make a mockery out of us and make a mockery out of the victims of 9/11. And it's disgusting. And we're partially to blame for that. But that was always the plan. That was always the plan of these people, was to, you know, get heroes like Jesse Ventura up there and then feed them garbage, or you know, whatever they've got to do to them to make them say what they're saying, you know, whether they threaten them or whatever. We know that they do those things, okay? And I'm not saying that I know that happened, but the thing is, we've seen it time and time again. These people come up, look at Charlie Sheen.
Yeah.
He's a freaking nutcase, right?
Yeah.
And Alex Jones is talking to him and, you know, lapping it up. He's his buddy going around to see him and all this sort of garbage. Now, that's just ridiculous, you know?
Yeah.
Charlie Sheen was off the handle a year ago. You know, he should have been dropped by people like Jones, but because there's money in it and it's exciting and he's a big star, he gets talked about, you know, and he gets interviewed, and same with Ventura. He's talking garbage now, but people will continue to interview him, and it's just sickening. And, you know, after, you know, 6 years of it, 5 years of it, you know, it just, you some people just can't do it anymore.
It does get really hard to wade through it. But from the looks of things, Richard Gage is not giving up. And I mean, I was really impressed with his performance on an interview where he was really being – it was set up to undermine all of the people there. It was done in Canada. It was that one with Jonathan Kay, who wrote this book called Among the Truthers. And they had Barry Zwicker and Zaremka, who's written a book, edited a book on 9/11, and Richard Gage on television on a Skype connection. You know, they were – I mean, I thought that presentation of that discussion was typical of what is done to try and direct us away from facts. They're trying to point us towards the people. They're trying to point us towards the personality of the people who believe things rather than the facts. And Richard just refused to be baited with that. He just kept repeating the facts and didn't play along with the theme of the show, which is to try and talk about truthers or try and talk about what conspiracy theorists think.
Well, that's what they tried to do with me on the trip when I went on the grill team on Triple M. Exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you listened to that interview, but they straight away, so who did 9/11? and, you know, all these sort of questions, right? And that's what they do. That's what they want to do. They want you to get you to concentrate on what it is you say happened,
yeah.
Okay? And they want us to get, to concentrate on the fictitious theories, you know? And that's the game. Now, Richard has figured that out a long time ago. He's been a warrior a long time for truth and justice.
Sure.
And he's well hardened. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he's doing a good job. But he's had some lessons he's had to learn and some bitter pills. And
yeah.
He's had to learn, like I did and like you did, that popularity, at one point when you're fighting a campaign like this, you have to say, well, popularity is good, but hang on, I think my integrity and I think my intellectual standing, you know, in the community, or I don't know what other word to use for it, but, you know, if people think you're a conspiracy nut or not is important. You know, it's important that people think that you're rational, they think you're reasonable, and they think that, you know, you're making sound arguments based on evidence. As soon as they think you're not, you put in the conspiracy nut box and no one's listening anymore. You might as well be, you know, singing a song. You know, no one's really listening. Like, you might be saying something, but it's only when you really stick to the facts. You mightn't have a lot of friends left after a while because there's so many people out there that want you to sprout every crazy theory under the sun.
Yeah.
But in the end, you're still standing and you still got your credibility. I remember writing to Richard about the CIT thing and saying that I thought my position was untenable in the organisation if he didn't clearly state that he wasn't supporting that group. And many other people wrote to him about that as well. And in the end, he had to... get to make a hard decision and become unpopular and step back from something that wasn't proven.
Yeah, it's really about staying on message. I mean, you know, it's a lesson from politics. You know, you've got to stay on message. And but you don't want to also do that to the point where you're delivering a false message, which is what a lot of happens in politics. So, you know, we've got these really bad examples everywhere of misinformation and spin. So what we're doing is really difficult. Got to wind it up. John, really, really great. Thank you so much for today. And good luck with everything with Qantas.
Yeah, no worries. And just remember, I'm not speaking on behalf of Qantas or the ALEA.
Absolutely. Okay, that's it from Truth News. See you next week.
Okay, bye-bye.